Hello, and welcome to another podcast by Fermat's Last Theater. I'm Alex Hancock, and I'm happy to be introducing Marilyn Annucci, recent winner of the Press 53 Award for her new book of poems, The Arrows That Choose Us. Marilyn is a professor in the Department of Languages and Literature at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, author of two chapbooks, Luck and Waiting Room, and has also won the Sunken Garden Poetry Prize. So Marilyn, welcome. Thanks for joining us. And I wanted to start by asking where the ghostwriter poems originated, how the ghostwriter poems came to be.
So initially, I'd been thinking about ghostwriters. I worked once in a administrative capacity for the UW system where I was writing for like the vice president of academic affairs and for other people. And I always thought it's interesting how in politics and in music industry and a lot of celebrities and CEOs have people who ghostwrite their work. And so there's the people up front who are getting the credit. And then there's the whole staff. It's sometimes one person if they're doing a book or a staff of people who are kind of keeping this person propped up in a way. It's like the puppet show and somebody gets the credit. And so I just find the idea of a ghostwriter an interesting figure because, I guess I was most interested in not what the ghostwriter was writing, but kind of the ghostwriter's life, because the ghostwriter is rather invisible, right? There's a sense of anonymity. So who's the ghostwriter rather than who's the person that the ghostwriter is writing for? And so in this book, you know, I decided to kind of imagine the ghostwriter like the ghostwriter's ex-wife, like, it sounds like it's going to be about the ghostwriter's ex-wife, but we get a lot more about the ghostwriter in that poem than the ex-wife, except her attitude toward the ghostwriter, kind of sarcastic look at the ghostwriter. We get the ghostwriter fortune cookies. I tried to imagine all the texts that we read in our lives where we don't know who the author is. I thought of fortune cookies, road signs. I mean, there's a lot of bureaucratic text, right? What things that are generated by the state, the government. And so I have that figure in
The Ghostwriter's Apprentice.
What was the poem? Yeah, The Ghostwriter's Apprentice. And I thought that was a lower level ghostwriter. You know, he's not working on a book. He's working on, you know, death certificates. What page is that?
That is on page 50.
Yeah, so that ghostwriter, this poem, The Ghostwriter's Apprentice, came from my pondering who's writing, you know, roadsides, ramp closed, right lane, or when you get your ticket when you go through a toll, who wrote all of that? The death certificates, the leases, the estate sales, all the small print kinds of things. There are more things that we read every day that have no authorship than that have authors. So initially I was going to write a whole book on the ghostwriter, the figure of the ghostwriter, there in all the different ways that you could imagine a ghostwriter. But I decided I just didn't generate enough poems. And then because this collection has a lot of this collection has a lot of poems about the past and about memory, and people have said there's a little bit of a haunted quality, you know, and I think that comes from that I'm writing a lot about the past in this collection, and also that I've interwoven these poems in the course of the larger manuscript. So this other voice comes in. And so just the idea of the ghostwriter, just the name the ghostwriter conjures up a little bit of a ghostliness or suggests a hauntedness. But it's also, as a writer myself, and not having had this book, I was working on this book over the course of 20 years, even though I have two other chapbooks and two other manuscripts, a lot of poems, I was trying to get this particular manuscript right. You know, I wanted this manuscript that had to do with mortality and love and grief and desire and memory and larger questions. And I couldn't quite get the balance of poems right. And I started to feel, and sometimes the manuscript would make it to the semifinalists in a contest or a finalist, but I just kept thinking, I'm never going to get this book out, you know. And so I was feeling this invisibility in some way, like I'm working on this. No one knows, you know, the hours I've spent on these different poems, and I've got file cabinets full of poems from when I was a lot younger. And so I think on some level I was identifying with a ghostwriter, even though I was working on my own work. I was like, there's somehow I felt this sense of invisibility or anonymity. I'm going to die. You know, posthumously, this book might come out or it might not. You know, I just thought. And so, so that's where I think putting the ghostwriter poems felt right to put them into this book.
Will you read some for us?
Sure. I'll start with a ghostwriter's apprentice. That's a, this one, he's not even a ghostwriter. And it's interesting too, because a lot of the ghostwriter poems, I imagine the ghostwriter is a male a lot of times. So I don't know if the ghostwriter is kind of my alter ego. And the ghostwriter is Jeannie. The ghostwriter is female and she's visiting the male writer. So it's interesting in terms of gender with the ghostwriter. So this is the ghostwriter's apprentice. He's assigned the most invisible jobs. Ramp closed or Milwaukee right lane. It takes its toll after the 100th mile marker, and he starts to speculate about the blur of passengers and mufflers and songs he can't hear through closed windows. Alive, he never gave them a thought, never wondered who wrote rest area or the numbers and names of exits on highway tickets he handed to booth operators, then sped off. He would have said bureaucrats if pressed, but no one asked. Sometimes he conjures the small print on leases, death certificates, estate sales. Before he can inhabit the spaces of others, he must experience humility, an absence of ego. Yield. And he has begun to. A white line down a divided highway. Not solid, but broken. Passing into anonymity and back. And with this poem, too, I think I was imagining this ghostwriter as having already passed over the line into another world. You know, actually, literally, a ghost who's a ghostwriter. Because when I say alive, he never gave them a thought. So there are, you know, there are those who have to write these kinds of leases and death certificates and estate sales and will never get any credit. But also, what do we need to learn as we let go of our self, of our lives, you know, everything we think of as the self, our identity? And that takes a certain amount of humility and absence of ego, and you have to yield. And so this, you know, so it became actually a little bit more metaphysical in terms of its, yeah, its reach.
Now, I noticed that in most of the ghostwriter poems, the ghostwriter is a guy, or specified as a male. But in the ghostwriter as Jeannie, she's specified as a female who appears to a writer who is not a ghostwriter.
And the writer is male in that. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I can read the ghostwriter as Jeannie. She rises out of the shower steam, the teapot, the fog that lifts over the struggling writer's backyard, and presses her palms against the panes. She sees the writer sitting at the kitchen table, sniffling over the story of his life, and she cries, boo, hoo, until he meets her eye, says, okay, you can do better. She rearranges the air, and he's a boy again, playing snaps in the schoolyard, playing beans, working Gimp, a gift for his mother, who's never not sad. And he doesn't want to cry, and he won't, and the Gimp is bright yellow and orange, and braided the way his mother braids her own hair when she sits alone in the darkened bedroom on the green chair and says, I'm sorry, when he finds her bureau drawer laid out on her bed, her scarves and Pond's face cream and church missal and tears. She wants to leave but has nowhere to go, she says. He doesn't want that part of his story. Take it out, he says. So the ghostwriter rubs the air as if shining plates, and it's gone. And the sadness on his chest lifts like a spoonful of sugar, and the ghostwriter props her feet on the stove. Dust of sun cones. She knows. It's lonely behind words. And I, you know, there's so much effort in writing, and the fact that this ghostwriter can just kind of rub the air to change the story. If only, right? I like that. You know, he doesn't want that part. Take it out. There is something liberating when you take something out. I mean, it's so much easier to just take it out than to put something in, right? To construct something. But, you know, just this, I like kind of the idea that you can go back into a life and remove parts of it that were problematic. They made, that part made him too sad. And,
eternal sunshine of the spotless mind.
Yeah. And I think of Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane. And, you know, they can restitch, you know, kind of like, so the people don't remember, the parents don't remember what just happened. Like, you know, the women, the three figures. And
the three fates?
Yeah,
they're
like the three fates, but they're working. They can just change something. And so when the parents come in, they come to get their child and they forgot what preceded this whole episode. And yeah, so I do like that idea.
You have so many poems that deal with memory, and I love that.
You were talking about that poem, the one that was based in England.
An Ocean Away.
Yeah, I Was an Ocean Away, which begins...
That's a longer poem.
Yeah, it is a longer poem. I could just read a little part. I could read part of that poem, like kind of the last part of it. And I could read just the very beginning, too, which was 19... So I Was an Ocean Away, and this poem was written really thinking about the difference in generation between... You know, when we lived without the internet, without cell phones, where we weren't checking in with people all the time, no one really knew where we were, and that was okay. I mean, I told my students, you know, when I spent my whole year in England, you know, there were no cell phones, no internet, just go out and, you know, ride my bike, and they're like, but that doesn't feel safe, like, you're just like, nobody knows where you are. And, yes, and it's a kind of anonymity. Sometimes we want that, we need it, we long for it. You just want to be on your own sometime and have that kind of solitude. And the thing is, even though we live in a culture where people are expecting us to text back or answer the phone or whatever, we can always turn it off. And so we can have that. It's just a matter of choice. But I think younger people don't think of that as a choice. And I have done exercises with my students and said, you know, just turn off your phone for 2 hours and don't do anything digitally. And how do you feel? And what are you going to do during that time when you have it to yourself? And some people really loved it and relished it and felt really calm. And they said they did some introspection and started to understand things about their lives and also just about how they were doing during the semester and thinking about things. And other students said they felt a lot of anxiety during that time. And they wondered what they were missing and sometimes if they went out and didn't have their cell phone, they didn't feel safe. More female students would say that. But it was really, this sense of being cut off and then really eager to come back and see what they'd missed. And like, there would be a lot of messages from texts from, where were you? Why weren't you answering? And sometimes from parents too. And I thought, parents need to kind of let their kids have some separation to grow. You know, they need their child to be responding. They're in college. They have to have them constantly responding back and forth. So I think, it's just an interesting, strange time that we live in compared to where we used to have this kind of, what I would say is just a freedom to be. So I'll just read the very beginning of I Was an Ocean Away, and then I'll jump to the last part. 19 and no email, no instant message, no chat, no nothing but a lumpy twin bed I sat on alone in gray and damp England circa 1981, which means you might not have been even a pixel in your mother's womb, not even one letter on a tiny screen, and I was crying on a bed because I felt it. I felt what you do not want to know, do not want to feel, do not want to believe as you pick up your cell phone to say, hey. I was a lone girl on a lumpy British bed in a priory with old nuns who gardened and left me aerograms. So that's the beginning of it. I kind of talk about that time in England, and then I'll jump down to the last part. This was the past, and I was seeing clearly out the window at the trees, which were beautiful and distinct in their dark lines and their rough skin. And the sky was not virtual, did not exist as a black hole in someone's mind, but was straight-up air in which I was living the truth of my own small existence, my own voice in my own head when I went out the door, when I said goodbye or did not, when I rode my bike through the walled roads into the open street, down the hill, over the bridge toward Oxford. I was the only one who knew where I was when I was passing the yellow leaves, the stone gargoyles with their bugged eyes and thick tongues. No GPS when I was pedaling the way blood pumps blood, the way it does when we are alive, even if no one else knows we are, how we go on, even when no one can reach us.
Another city, that was London, right?
Oxford.
Oxford, mm-hmm. Right. And The Women of the Kazan Cathedral takes place in St. Petersburg, Russia.
St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's a memory, again, a memory. Yeah, that poem, The Women of the Kazan Cathedral in St. Petersburg, Russia. And there's a kind of haunted quality. Not not they're not ghosts, but there's a way that they hang out at the cathedral and tend the candles that there's a kind of ghostly quality to it. So I'll read that. Quick ancients in kerchiefs move quietly as breath among carousels of candles, snuffing the slender tapers like stumps of cigarillos, tossing them into the tin pail. If the inch of wax still holds prayer, still possesses the pilgrim's desire to burn all the way down, it doesn't matter, these mothers of Christ say with their silence, say with their refusal to meet your eyes. Another stub, another prayer has burned long enough. And I did spend a month in St. Petersburg. One of my poems was given an award in summer literary series when it was held in St. Petersburg. I think it was around 2009. I can't even remember exactly what year. Maybe it was 2003. When was I there? And I spent some time in the Kazan Cathedral, just observing people. I have another poem in there. Yeah, I'm not going to read that, but it's in the book. Yeah, I have another poem about that, and I have a poem in Peter's City, so I have a few poems with allusions to that time period when I was in Russia. Do you want me to read another ghostwriter poem?
The nursing home one, I guess it's Ghostwriter's Nursing
Home. Yeah, in Ghostwriter's Nursing Home, again, so thinking I was more interested in the ghostwriter than in the writer, than in the figures that the ghostwriter spent their lives serving. And so I imagined them all kind of at the end of their lives, all these ghostwriters together. And, you know, here they are, Ghostwriter's Nursing Home. No one talks about their own lives. And the stories of movie stars, presidents, and divas are old. It's nice to sit, let someone else dish. Well, it's worth a snicker over lunch among goblin gossips out to pasture. Rarely do they feel regret, the could-have-been-a-contender crap. Someone shuts them up. Big name, steam on a mirror. Done. Out back, there's birds in a feeder, and enough stories to last a... Don't need those either. I know that one. It's like, yeah, and in a way, what do all the stories add up to, right? What do all the books add up to? Everything, even this book, you know, I was so worked on this book for so long. It's just one little drop of a book in the midst of millions of drops of books and words and so much, you know, it just all goes down the big stream, river, into the ocean and up into the air. And
what lasts, what remains worthy in the eyes of the world?
Well, I guess things are important and then they're not important. Or, you know, there's a sense, yeah, I'm grateful for certain books in my life and I'm grateful that people are creating art and just, you know, contributing. But I'd also, there's a part of me that really is about, like, I know we have to let it all go in the end. I guess so it doesn't mean that it's not important. We have the moment. What we have all the time is these moments. And then in these moments when I'm grateful, I'm reading something and I think, somebody else expressed something I felt. So there's that communion or you don't feel as alone. And I guess that's why I was always drawn to literature. You know, it was like, I feel less alone because somebody else lived and expressed this, however it came through, whether through conversation with someone or actually written down in a poem or a story or, yeah, so.
There's a wonderful line from your interview with the Arts and Literature Lab, which is on their website. You said, attention is a form of love.
Yeah, I think that's important, right. Attention is a form of love. I don't think we pay enough attention, close attention to people, to animals, to the world around us. And that when we do, and we notice, that's the only way we can notice something is by being attentive. And when we notice, I feel like in a way that is an act of love. It's an act of validation. It's seeing someone or something for what they are. And as much as we can perceive anything through our own filter, right? We're always mediating experience for ourselves. But yeah, and I think, but just to be present is an act of love. It's the only way that we can come to know anyone or anything. Yeah. So I guess that's partly a lot of writing is you know, there's some very close observation, which feels kind of meditative after a while. And even if I'm writing about the past, there's a meditative way. I'm going backward and I'm going deep into kind of re-seeing and rethinking that. And it always feels moments, it can take me hours to work on something, but it will just seem like moments, you know, the time. It's almost like we're in another time dimension when we're working on something like that.
One of the poems I love that I think deals with attention in a different way is Cogito Ergo.
Oh, Cogito.
Where you're taking a single object and considering it from the viewpoint of several different senses.
Cogito Ergo. Right. I thought the apple was its rosiness until my lips, my teeth, my tongue opened. I knew the apple then was this astonishment of tart and sweet. I met with all my hunger, all my breath, and yet it was not this, but something dark it spilled to me. I knew the apple deeply then, how it had grown, but I was wrong again. The apple was no more than snow, as cool as what I thought I'd known, forgotten out of grief until this spring, this swoon of strange perfume, of apple everywhere and nowhere, yet so much this nothing that I knew. Yeah, the paradox of it all.
How about just one more ghostwriter poem?
Sure, I could read another ghostwriter poem. Which one do you want to read?
Well, I love the ghostwriter of westerns as critic, but it does have that dialogue at the beginning.
You like Ghostwriter's Ex-Wife, too.
Oh, yeah, Ghostwriter's Ex-Wife is wonderful.
Okay, yeah, so Ghostwriter's Ex-Wife, I guess I really was interested in the ghostwriter, but I imagine, so how the ghostwriter's ex, yeah, exactly, yeah, how the ex-wife might perceive the ghostwriter. Maybe I was watching some Louise Brooks films at the time. I went through a bit of a silent movie phase. And so that's reference. She was well-known silent film star, as you know. You like her a lot.
Oh, right. The Lulu look.
Yes, right. The Lulu look with her hair. So Ghostwriter's Ex-Wife. He remembered Greta Garbo's birthday, September 18, a Virgo, of course, but not mine. Garbo didn't need talkies with that face, he would say, though he couldn't imagine Camille without her. He adored stuffing words into beautiful women's mouths. Well, I've got my own mouthful now, back from the dead, Daddy's old apparition. I braised asparagus, roasted duck, while he sat at a table laid by invisible hands, his eyes, all aperture, closed on air. Only Germany appreciated Louise Brooks, you know. He tried to write to her years after Pandora's Box. Cursed Hollywood, he would say, shallow as an A-cup. He liked brothel scenes, tawdry couture, sassy lines, but I was the real vision, the wife in the light of the TV box, there, not there. Yeah, so she takes him to task for his sexism. I know.
Garbo and Louise Brooks in one poem. Wow. In her memoir, Portrait of an Anti-Star, for which, by the way, she had two ghostwriters, Louise Brooks mentioned that she and Garbo had a one-night stand.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting. I know. I wonder if I should have said when part of the invisibility to feeling invisibility is not having led like a heteronormative life. You know,
you can
like
say it now.
Yeah, I think part of the invisibility and the attraction to the ghost writer, the kind of behind the scenes, is also having not lived a typical kind of heteronormative life. And so in that way, women especially, right, are not as visible or not taken. I don't know, if you don't have children, if you're not with a man or married, or versus if you're with a woman, or if you're single, if you've chosen a celibate life or a monastic life. I mean, there's all these other lives that are not in that kind of typical mainstream that's validated. So everyone who's outside of that, a little bit more on the margins, is seen just, there's something about that feels a little more invisible. You're not another form, even though you might be very well known in certain spheres and with certain people in your life. But it's just, yeah, I think it conjured that for me. And also why I wrote the poem Mild Interrogation of Self as Vessel, where I'm, you know, interrogating, you know, why did you not have a child? And woman as vessel. And there are, you know, those attitudes of the woman as the vessel. It's like, you know, you marry and you have children and that's the primary Yeah, you bear somebody, and that's what makes your life valid, where there's so many ways to have a life, so many ways to live. So that was, you know, that comes across in the book too, in some poems, I think. And it kind of, the ghostliness of it all is part of it. It's interesting too, I'll just say one other thing, like the ghostwriter interests me as a figure in our culture because they do get paid, and it depends, like, you know, people who aren't very well known might get paid a lot less than someone who's pretty
well known. They get paid more than poets though.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But I do know someone who recently did he ghostwrote a book that's going to be probably eventually will make the New York Times bestseller list, several of them do, right, that they're ghostwritten, and he ended up getting about 75,000, whereas a lot of ghostwriters maybe are on the lot lower
end. Is this one of those as told to books?
I can't really go into it. Yeah, but there are celebrity books, and politicians hire ghostwriters, and entertainment people hire ghostwriters, and medical people in the medical field might hire a ghostwriter to do something. So so they sometimes publishers will put a lot of money into a project they really believe in, and then the ghostwriter a lot of times does all the research. But anyway, but aside from that, like, so I'm interested in ghostwriters as figures behind the scenes, almost like they've got the puppet show going, the higher you get in education too, there's a lot of people who are writing for the presidents and for the vice presidents, and just as in politics. And so people get letters and they'll say, oh, so-and-so wrote to me, or so-and-so said this. Or there's even ghostwriters for Facebook statuses and for, blogs now and tweets, and, you know, not everybody. So you have the name. It's all about the brand, right? The person becomes the brand in a way. But I'm also interested in just the ghost. And so I kind of like the behind the scenes. Who are these people who are doing that? What's their life all about? And also I like the idea of a ghost writer who's really a ghost. And sometimes I play with that that there's actually someone who is a ghost. And I had in the ghost who's crossing over in the Ghostwriter's Apprentice, the kind of, yeah, you need to lose your ego. And so what does it mean to be a ghost? And I was thinking about the idea of ghost in a way, just the concept of a ghost. And some people have seen ghosts and some people don't believe in ghosts. But there's the vestiges. I feel like there's a vestige of what it means to be human in the ghost, right? You see this, like this kind of, what is it? Like the aura, it's almost like a screen. It feels very cinematic in a way. It's like you're left with, palimpsest. It's like what's behind the world that we have. And to believe in a ghost or to see a ghost, in a way, it's hopeful, right? It's like we're not just snuffed out. We're coming back. We're someone's coming back and checking things out, or someone is here to warn you or to lead you somewhere else, or to kind of.
That's the one figure in supernatural or horror movies who's often presented as a benign character.
Yeah, but like, yes, there's this connection between this world and this other world, in this sense that that what you had doesn't just absolutely disappear. You know, it's like when if you turn out a light and it doesn't absolutely go all the way off, and it kind of just slowly fades out, or it's like a fade out in a movie. I don't know. I like the idea, and I don't know if ghosts do exist, how long they stick around. It seems, in a way, the human drama, I think it could be very fun and interesting to stick around and just be invisible, the whole invisible cloak idea, and be able to watch the human drama as a ghost go and follow whoever you want. I suppose that you could never get bored. You could have an infinity of that, just constantly following.
But then you might start to feel like you're just having to watch the same story.
Well, I do think, I know, and I think that's what, even in the human life, you kind of get tired of that. It's like, okay, that's just another form. It's just taking another form here, and I'm ready for something else. So they're going to give us something that truly surprises and that we haven't conceived of yet.
Which is rare.
Yeah, which is rare. And so, yeah. So I think, yeah, the human mind, it has many configurations through our imagination and our memory and our desire. But ultimately, maybe we keep kind of reinventing things. And I mean, I think, though, that ultimately maybe true wisdom is eventually letting all of it go. I don't know. And just existing. But then why do we have a whole world of sensuality with bodies? And
then why write?
I know. If you let go, there's a detachment, right? There's the impulse to say, let's just let it go and just be this mind of, like, just be kind of united with everything, like with being. But also, I mean, we do have senses and we live in a sensual world. And there's so much beauty. I mean, humans have messed up so much. But on the other side, when we are living well and wisely, we have created amazing things, and there's amazing
beauty. And amazing poems. But even writing means letting go, doesn't it? Because you have to, at a certain point, just be willing to stop polishing.
Yeah, that's true. Any act of creation, right? How do you decide, okay, that's it, you know, it's done as well as it can be, and put it out there. And yeah, and that's why some writers, you know, you could say they keep writing the same poem or there's similar poems, because maybe one, you wrote this one form and then here's another form of it. Well, look at an apple tree. How many apples come on the tree, right?
Or all the different ways you can experience a single apple, as in Cogito Ergo.
I know it. Exactly. And that's so true of life too. I was, you know, I've always been drawn to the metaphysical poets, and
like George Herbert?
Herbert, yeah, and Donne, and also Dickens. I love her riddle-like quality, and that just playing with ideas, and this is our experience, what it means to be human. Oh, there's kind of an essential humanness, but there's also so many culturally constructed ways to be human, and depend on environment and context and what class and race and gender, all those things. But there is something about just the human heart and psyche and mind that no matter what, across boundaries, and that's what music, I always think music really captures, you know, really speaks to people. Anyone, no matter who they are, like suddenly a certain tune comes up, a certain melody, and people respond, you know. I always wish I wish I were a musician, that I could, yeah, without words. Words are hard, or a lot harder than, and yet we have a musicality in our writing. We can work with the music of language, and then that creates a certain tone. But yeah, to be able to just, you know, remember when I was in Europe, somebody entered a train once and just started playing this really upbeat music. It just changed the whole mood. Just came right into a train.
Was he playing a boombox?
No, they had an instrument with them. I think they had a guitar, and they just started playing. And I just thought, oh, I would love to be able to do that.
Well, thank you so much, Marilyn.
Yeah, thanks for interviewing me.
Marilyn Annucci. Her new book is The Arrows That Choose Us, winner of the Press 53 Award for Poetry.